darf ich sie mit Eisbike.
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den under the stairs here at Dirt Towers in Adlington, Chorley, in the northwest of the green and pleasant land of England. On my right is my great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. This time it's obscured by VHS tapes that I found out in the attic as I've been catching up on some of my favourite television programmes from the past. Here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actress Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, the eternal champion has appeared as nothing. For the first time it appears blank. I need to delve a little deeper. Ah yes, there's a little annex, I remember. A ridiculously tiny homemade shrine to the actor Judy Trott. When I was 16, I dreamed of going in the forest and meeting Maid Marian. We'd get married and never split up. We'd live together without a care in the world. Regular listeners to the Grogpod will know that we deal with games and nostalgia. This time the dial is very much turned towards nostalgia, for this time we're looking at the TV programme Robin of Sherwood. This is part of a series of Grogpods about the cultural context that helped shape UK gaming in the 1980s. We talked before about the influence of White Dwarf, the fanzine culture, 2000 AD, and how they contributed to the uniquely British flavour of fantasy gaming. If you're of a particular age living in the UK, you'll know that Robin of Sherwood had a significant effect on gaming. More significant than the appearance of Call of Cthulhu, more significant than any mechanical innovation that hit the scene in the mid-80s. For us and many others, it defined the look and feel of our role-playing. It tapped into our psychogeography in ways that we'll go on to discuss. Consider this from Graham Kinnisberg, a long-time member of the Grog Squad, who is now an AD for Game of Thrones, no less. He's clear about the influence of Robin of Sherwood when he made the following comment, our Facebook group. This version of Robin Hood seems inextricably linked in my memory with the gaming of that era. We were playing MERP near constantly at the time, so there was lots of inspiration from the show, whether it be the costuming of Michael Parade's Robin seems to be the very image of a ranger, Dunedain, Judy Trott's Marian, a willowy elf princess, and the show's approach to pagan mysticism and hints of dark magic seem straight out of the low-key school of fantasy RPGs. Very atmospheric, enhanced even more by a wonderful score by Clannad. Add in some cool psychics, stroke PC types, twin sword wielding Nazir being far and away the coolest, of course, and he had lots to engage the young mid-80s gamer. The one show that would delay me from stepping out of the door en route to the above-mentioned games of MERP. And who can forget the wonderful and dramatic end to season 2. The show's still widely available for streaming and downloads and DVDs and Blu-rays, so after listening to this episode, I hope that you'll seek it out. In Open Box, we're joined by Graham Staplehurst, who, for a brief period, was a prolific game writer who made contributions to White Dwarf and a number of supplements for Middle-earth role-playing, including The Gates of Mordor, as well as creating Robin of Sherwood tie-in game books with his friend Paul Mason and an Iron Crown Robin Hood supplement. After the interview, Eddie and Blythe join me to talk about Seven Poor Knights from Acca, episode 4 from season 1. It's a new feature, Grogglebox, where we'll have a scene-by-scene discussion so you too can recreate that 80s experience by surrounding yourself with the oaky smell of patchouli oil. Wear an Italian Army surplus jacket from Armani and Navy stores, covered with band patches and embroidery that isn't quite finished. It says Marill on the back. We had great fun recording this section. Let us know what you think of it, as we intend to do more in the future. I'll be back at the end to bring you up to date with the latest Grognard Files projects. Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Potted history.
What I did feel was that outlaws tend to be very young and very idealistic, and so my vision, to use a rather highfalutin word about a commercial television series, was that they should be very young, very enthusiastic, and in a sense, revolutionary. Richard Carpenter. Robin Hood is a mythic figure, part of the English psyche, and in the same way that Western movies reflect American cultural concerns of the generation, Robin Hood is a figure that reoccurs in different eras as an index of the cultural zeitgeist. In ballads, poems, novels by Walter Scott and others, TV series and Hollywood movies, a common man facing down oppression. By the 80s, it seemed that he was destined to be a parody of a paternalistic utopia that had been abandoned by Reaganomics and Thatcherism. In The Time Bandits, for example, Robin appears as a well-meaning philanthropist. Have you seen the poor? Oh, I'm sure you'll like them. Of course, they haven't got two pennies to rub together, but that's because they're poor. By the 1990s, Robin was a corporate all-action hero played by Kevin Costner, whose interpretation owes something to Robin of Sherwood that was first aired in the UK in the spring of 1984. There were three seasons in the series, with 25 episodes. This interpretation of Robin was gritty, authentic, featuring real-world historical elements and a pagan mysticism. Where did it come from? To understand what's unique about Robin of Sherwood, you have to go to its origins, and to understand its creator, Richard Carpenter. Richard Carpenter began his career as a jobbing actor, appearing in smaller parts on television, including Hancock's Half Hour, Dixon the Dot Green and Zed Cars. Driving one day, he stopped outside a farm to look at a map, and written on the gate of the farm was the name Cat Weasel. He started building a character around the name, an odd-looking, whiskered old man, a wizard from the past, who is brought into the present day and interprets in technological developments as a form of magic. He sold the concept to London Weekend Television. It became a children's television programme that many of us will recall because of its folky weirdness. He went on to write more for television, contributing episodes to other children's programmes of the era, such as Black Beauty, The Famous Five, and a favourite of the armchair adventurers, the brilliantly eccentric Dr. Snuggles. He also created the children's television programme The Ghosts of Motley Hall, where ghosts from different historical eras have adventures set in a crumbling mansion. Following the success of the series, he also created Dick Turpin and The Smuggler, really great adventure programmes. He had a long-held ambition to create a version of Robin Hood that was set in the real-world history and had more authenticity, where the outlaws were rebels in a dangerous environment. He was commissioned by Lord Grey to create the television series, but ATV were beset with financial problems following the flops of feature films that they'd financed, such as Raise the Titanic, which Lord Grey famously suggested that it would have been cheaper to lower the Atlantic. Also, Jim Henson had taken his lucrative Muppet Show away from ATV. The project looked doomed until Goldcrest, a British production company who had been riding high following the success of Gandhi, agreed to produce the scripts with the joint finance from a British TV company, HTV, and a Californian cable channel, Showtime. The programme was recorded using film stock at Pinewood Studios and on location in Bristol and places in Northumberland, standing in for Sherwood Forest. Ian Sharp was brought in as the director in the first series, who had previously worked on The Professionals and Lewis Collins' SAS movie, Who Dares Wins. He directed the entire first series, which gives the continuity of style. And they went on the hunt for a young actor who would look good in tights. And Michael Praed was in a West End production of Pirates of Penzance. With his wiry frame and delicate features, he gave a mystical quality to the role, more of an elven ranger than an effect swashbuckler. His gentle face was perfect for the 80s, while the others were covered in dirt, his hair was always impeccable. His looks, if not his acting, caught the attention of the producers of Dynasty. He was replaced in the third season by Jason Connery, son of Sean. And while the stories are strong in the third season, Sherwood seemed a little duller without Praed. It's really the first two seasons that are magical. The rest of the cast included Ray Winston, who channeled a West Ham football hooligan for Will Scarlett, Judy Trott, who trained as a dancer at Royal Ballet, and Little John was played by Clive Mantle, who would go on to play Lord Great John Umber in Game of Thrones. Mark Ryan, as Nazir, had a non-speaking part for the first episode, but he was added as a permanent character. After the casting, the addition of a Saracen to the Merry Men, replacing a character named Edmund, only happened because Ian Sharp liked Mark Ryan. The creators of Kevin Costner's Prince of Thieves assumed that the Saracen Merry Man was part of the legend when they used Robin of Sherwood as a source. Just think, Morgan Freeman wouldn't have had a job if Mark Ryan hadn't been such good drinking company. The young cast was fantastic. They appear contemporary with regional accents. But it was Robert Addy, reprising his performance as Mordred in Excalibur as Guy's Gisborne, and Nicholas Grace as Robert de Renault, the Sheriff of Nottingham, who were the baddies we loved to hate. Gisborne, a Norman soldier who was single-minded in his hatred of the Wolf's Head Robin, and de Renault was a consummate politician who managed to manoeuvre his way into power. But he doesn't relish the work. He's aspirational, yet holds both the serfs and the aristocrats that he works for with complete contempt. So, who was Robin of Sherwood? A modern primitive who dabbled with transgressive behaviour, but wasn't quite sure about it. Who put friends above family. Who railed against the institutions of state and church. A Robin that struggled to articulate his idealism. A Robin that was ultimately ineffective. Yes, he was our Robin. A Generation X Robin.
Open Box!
Welcome to Open Box, the part of the podcast where we look backwards to look forwards, how our gaming of the past has informed how we play today. This time, I'm joined by Graeme Staplehurst, contributor to White Dwarf and whole supplement to the Iron Crown Enterprises Middle-Earth role-playing and developer of Robin of Sherwood-inspired supplements and a game book tie-in. Hello, Graeme.
Hello.
The first thing that we always start off with, Graeme, is just to ask our guests, how did you start in the hobby?
Well, I started in the hobby through board games. As a very young person, while still at secondary school, I really enjoyed board games. And even at the age of, 11 or 12, I was busy inventing games. I remember that my father worked with very early computers and brought home stacks of coloured punch cards. And I was always interested in trying to find new things to do with these different coloured punch cards, big IBM punch cards.
So what board games were you playing?
Things like Wildlife, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous game. There was a lovely Ravensburger game about travelling through Europe and pinning little flags into a map. And then it got on, and at secondary school we got into diplomacy. I guess I discovered the gaming hobby, in the wider sense, through diplomacy. And I also remember playing diplomacy during history class. Part of our school was in a Norman archway next to an abbey. And our history class was in the archway, and there were very wide pillars holding the roof up, and so you could we made a little diplomacy board out of cardboard and sticky back plastic, which you could move little sticky plastic pieces around on, and it fitted nicely behind the pillar, and so the teacher didn't know what we were doing while we were busy playing diplomacy.
And so when did you first encounter role-playing games?
It was Dungeons & Dragons. The first one I owned was actually a photocopied set of Tunnels & Trolls rules, but it was actually the Dungeons & Dragons game that I guess a friend of mine must have got hold of some sort of a copy of. I was living at the time in Belgium. My parents moved to Belgium back in 1975. I remember exercise books in Belgium tended to have squares on rather than just lines, and they were ideal for drawing your dungeon maps on. So exercise books didn't always get used for schoolwork. And because we didn't know any better, I guess, we were always inventing extra stuff. I mean, I'm sure everybody did. Later in life, I discovered some people who absolutely stuck by rule books and so on, but I was never one of those people. It's a creative pastime, so I think everybody should be encouraged to be creative.
Now, one of the things I first remember of you is in White Dwarf. Now, this you won't realise, but this article had a profound effect on our gaming in Bolton, and that was To Catch a Thief, which you did for Traveller.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Traveller was actually... I think because it was we got into AD&D, and then that's when, you know, I was a little bit older, a little bit, had some pocket money and so on, could actually buy rule books. But Traveller was the one that actually, I think, captured my imagination more. I used to read quite a lot of science fiction.
So your Traveller games, because the reason why it caught our imagination is because inevitably all of our Traveller games ended up as being pirates, thieves and general vagabonds. Your article actually inspired our referee to make it more tricky for us with various traps, things to prevent us from stealing stuff all the time. So yes. I blame you in some ways for that.
For making your life more interesting.
Yes. Because it was quite a prescient article as well, because it had retina scans and things like that, didn't it?
Well, as I say, I think I would say I only ever stole stuff, or was in, at the very least, was it only ever inspired by what I read elsewhere. It's interesting, I was alerted to a project by a post by David Brin about Isaac Asimov in 1984, wrote some predictions about what it would be like 35 years hence, and now we are 35 years away from that. Someone is now, or maybe this little collaboration to predict what it'll be like 35 years from now. With any prediction, some of it's right and some of it's wrong. But so yes, I'm not surprised I managed to get some things right.
When did you make that leap from playing games to making contributions to White Dwarf?
Well, of course, there's an intermediate step, which is writing in fanzines. So I think the first fanzine I came across was The Beholder. I've wrote a fanzine of my own for a while, more of a social thing, necessarily even than a games one, but it was called The Wind's 12 Quarters. Most people that produced a zine did it so they didn't have to buy other people's zines, so they could trade with them.
And were you part of the community then? Did you attend conventions?
Yes. Through fandom, I got to know people like Paul Mason and Ian Marsh and a whole variety of other people, Mark Gascoigne. And, of course, you know, they went on to work at Games Workshop, Mark for quite a few years, but Ian as a sub-editor for a while at White Dwarf and so on. Paul Coburn as well, who then went off to TSR to edit Imagine. So yes, I got to know these people through informal conventions. But yeah, I like to write, and I didn't find it difficult, which was very fortunate at the time, but also very fortunate that the writing standards that were required were very low. So you could get away with almost anything, as long as you were reasonably literate, and I guess I was reasonably well read at that time as well.
And you mentioned MIRB, and that's probably the game that you most closely associated with. Is that true to say? So tell us about how you became involved in that.
Like many people of my generation, Lord of the Rings was an absolute cornerstone of your reading and actually of your cultural reference points. One of the things that always informed me, my view of AD&D was always quite a negative one. I'd play it, but as I say, we'd often be trying to bend or break the system because the system, particularly the magic, was so mechanistic. The sorts of literature that I've enjoyed, people like Alan Garner, they're much more worlds where magic is not mechanistic, it's unpredictable, it's not something that you meddle with lightly, I suppose, as Gandalf would say. And actually, as I started to write, even in Traveller, I often tried to think about, alien science as a form of magic. And so when Middle-earth role-playing came to my attention, I was very excited by that, the chance to role-play in a world that I knew pretty well, loved. I'd read Lord of the Rings back to front several times, read all the appendices, read the Silmarillion. Probably wasn't much more at that time in terms of, obviously there's a lot more been published since about the world. But yeah, it was something that I felt very happy to immerse myself in. It fitted with my worldview and my cultural touch points.
We did have MIRB, but we didn't play it an awful lot, because it was finding a way into the world that was gameable. I think we were always
creating a story that worked and didn't destroy the story that was there anyway.
Exactly.
And obviously I'd written one or two things for White Dwarf, but I wrote for Iron Crown partly out of a desire to show the Americans how it should be done. And that sounds very arrogant, but obviously I had a very great sensitivity to the fact that Tolkien's a great British writer. I've enjoyed the Peter Jackson films, but obviously they're not the films that Tolkien would have made or envisaged. And I wouldn't have wanted to go in that direction. I wanted to look upon The Lord of the Rings as a treasury with huge amounts of tiny hidden secrets, and I wanted to use those little secrets as the seeds of adventures, to acknowledge, for example, Tolkien's background as a linguist and work on languages, and to have language and writing and some of those sort, those aspects of his work. I wanted to pick up on the subtle differences in race, not the gross differences. I wanted to use the subtleties of light and shade within the work. Yes, you have out and out heroes, but the heroes all have flaws, and everybody has difficulties to overcome, and a lot of those are quite small things in a way. So yeah, I wanted to use the fact that you could zoom in on a tiny detail in this enormous and hugely rich world. So that's what I did. And I wanted to pay tribute to, Tolkien's historical knowledge, his cultural appreciation and so on. So when I wrote, I typically did quite a lot of research. I actually gave up my job for a year to largely write MERP work, which was very unprofitable, and so I had to go back to work after the year. But it was hugely, hugely satisfying as a thing to do.
Because I think at this time, I think that's why it's so fascinating at this point in time, when you were writing, there was more potential in role-playing games to do something
absolutely.
More. And
yes.
I think that richness of detail is part of that, isn't it? That desire to use it as a vehicle to tell story.
You know, yes, that's right. We, you know, everybody used to refer to AD&D as hack and slay and Monty Hall and all of these other terms. And to be honest, actually, if you didn't want to play it that way, you didn't have to play it that way. But, you know, largely the people that played it seemed to go in that direction. One of the games I wished I'd always played and never got into was Empire of the Petal Throne. I played a little bit of RuneQuest. I never played a lot of RuneQuest and would have liked to explore Glorantha a lot more as well. So certainly it was of the period where there was significant expansion into, as you say, much more storytelling worlds. But you see, I think even for something like Traveller, I would have, you know, I appreciated it, its ability to not dictate what you did. You know, it was very much, here's a setting, here's some very simple, you know, frameworks for how things can be resolved when there's a conflict. And really, that's all you need for a role-playing game.
Of course, with MERP, the combat was brutal and criticals were nasty. Mechanics force people down a story route because you're going to avoid combat at whatever cost.
Yeah, on the whole, I think you're right. it's interesting. Yeah, it came, obviously, the system came from Rollmaster, and I never played Rollmaster. And in fact, at that time when I was writing, I was tending to use HeroQuest a lot. There were one or two occasions, I can't remember which ones now, but some supplements I sent to ICE. The laborious bit of working out stats in MERP almost bored me to tears, and you know, I'm sure at times I said, can someone else do this please, because yeah, I just cannot be bothered.
This episode is all about Robin of Sherwood and an appreciation of that, and that's why I wanted to reach out to you, because you got involved in some game supplements and a gaming book about the series. I just wanted to talk to you about the series, and you know, how did you encounter it, and what were your initial thoughts of it?
Well, I mean, there wasn't a huge amount of fantasy on TV or in entertainment at that time. So it was absolutely going to catch your attention. I think, again, gamers, I don't know about all of them, often have an interest in history, historical recreation. I have a son now who role plays as one of his activities, board games as well, but he also is a member of a Normannis society of recreationists and wears chainmail and has a bloody great sword. I think it goes back to that fascination with history, and so certainly I had that, and yeah, something that was historical that also had some magic in it. I think that was obviously the huge innovation for the ITV series, was putting magic into it, and in some, you know, reasonably subtle ways. It wasn't, you know, I guess it was more mysticism than magic. Yeah, it was a good set of ingredients, a story people thought they knew but was able to be retold. The addition of a new ingredient that seemed contemporary, and obviously things like the cast and the music, that they really all came together. And I think, again, you know, like Doctor Who and so on, the Robin of Sherwood series did bridge that sort of children, young adult and grown-up divide. You know, it could appeal to all of those different people. Tales of good versus evil and so on.
I think Richard Carpenter's ambition as well, wasn't it, was to portray, to recast some of the popular mythology or Robin Hood in popular culture and give it more of a historical authenticity.
From the Hollywood, you know, tights and feathered hats, yes.
More like rebels and
guerrillas,
yeah. Guerrilla warfare, yep. Yeah.
And actually this idea of the folk hero, again, one of probably the people I read most, actually, but partly because he wrote more than anybody else, was Michael Moorcock. I suspect that Carpenter, you know, just had a little bit of the eternal Chan Champion in his Robin of Sherwood.
Yes, yeah. But yeah, I think you're right that Carpenter was tapping into that myth, and the idea of the rebel as role plays, it's appealing to see a party of characters as well.
You know, yes, absolutely, that's right. I mean, yeah, it could almost be an archetypal dungeon group, couldn't it? And, you know, a very original D&D group. Here's the cleric, here's the thief, here's the fighter. Didn't really have a mage, but, you know, here's the half-troll, Little John, or whatever it was that you needed to have.
How did the game book come about? So the King's Demon.
Well, there's a pair of them, and my name appears on one, Paul's appears on the other, but actually we both wrote both of them.
Ah, really?
Yes. So, yeah, they're both collaborations. But since Carpenter's name had to appear on them as well, the publishers said, well, we can't have three names. We divvied it up in that way. So that was all down to the lovely Mark Gascoigne, who was writing already for Puffin at the time and introduced us. Yeah, got us the gig. Paul and I were sharing a flat in Putney. Originally, Mark was going to do one as well, actually. So there were going to be three originally, but Puffin decided that maybe the wave of enthusiasm over Robin was subsiding. There wasn't a fourth season, and so the third one didn't happen in the end.
So the rules are a little more complicated than fighting fantasy. So you devised rules for it, didn't you?
We did, yes. Fighting fantasy books weren't bad, but actually I was never into them particularly. So having written something similar is quite odd in a way. At the time, as I said, I'd quit my job, or was planning to quit my job, actually. And this was one of the things. Getting a contract for this was part of the way I could feel reasonably secure, because I could put, you know, a month's work into it and be sure I'd get something back at the end of it. Yeah, we wanted to have a way to reflect more of the atmosphere, if you like. And so I think probably the combat was the most significant difference, having a little, you know, figure and marking wounds on it and things. But
I have a copy. The thing that strikes me about it is the brilliant illustrations in it from Russ Nicholson.
We were so fortunate. And actually, Russ not only is a great artist, he's a great artist for that sort of book, because obviously he can take, you know, instruction and inspiration and so on. So we were very careful in what we asked him to draw and what it needed to show and not show and all the rest of it.
Were there restrictions on what you could and couldn't do with the characters?
That was a very light touch, I think. Although Carpenter's name appears on it, I doubt he ever looked at it before it was published. Yeah, no, again, these things are great fun to write. Getting a couple of giant sheets of paper and drawing an enormous flowchart and then working out how many boxes you need to fill in, because you have to have a set amount of paragraphs and all the rest of it. Somehow, yeah, just then renumbering everything at the end is the tedious part, of course. But
the more substantial Robin Hood supplement is the role-playing campaign. Was that ever planned to be a tie-in?
We'd done a bit of research for the Sherwood game books, but I'd also run a campaign myself, which was a MERP campaign, very similar, at least to start off with, to Robin Hood. So it was very much the same sort of principle, the setting, the setup of it. I went to Iron Crown and said, do you think you can get the license? And I don't know whether they really tried or not, but obviously the answer came back, well, no, it'd be far too expensive, we can't do that. And it's, why would we need to? Let's just do it as Robin Hood. It's a great idea. They knew of Robin of Sherwood. I don't think it was massive in the States. It did get over there, and that's what got Michael Praed his gig on Dynasty. But yeah, you know, it was sort of like, yeah, but this is a great archetypal thing. And to give them credit, Iron Crown did think, you know, this is something that we could do more of, folktale type of settings, you know, from many sorts of, you know, cultures or whatever. But there's not many people as famous as Robin Hood, so it's a good place to start. I mean, I knew that there would have to be more than just Robin Hood in it, which is why, you know, I developed three different campaigns and did a huge amount of research for that book, and it was so rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, you can feel the research. I mean, it is packed with enticing detail, and if people get hold of it, you know, that you'll see village plans and castle plans. Adventures at the back do very much have the flavour of the series, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely wanted to try to capture that, and, you know, having systems that, you know, had some magic in them, some more than others and so on, but obviously, you know, that nice low level magic in MERP, you know, suited the setting perfectly. And of course, you know, you didn't have to use those elements if you didn't want to, and that was one of the things with Robin Sherwood, almost, you know, and Hearn. Was he really affecting things, or was he just a guy in a stag's cloak who was just, you know, sort of twisting your mind a bit? So,
and in here you use the Green Man Hearn substitute. Yes.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I love English folklore and folk tales, and I wanted to put in as many different little bits and pieces as I could. Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting ones was the whole thing about what I think of as the Welsh campaign, you know, having the Spear of Longinus in there, you know, so a Christian relic. But it's great. There are so many, you know, different bits of history that we've got, and folk tales, and everything from, like, you know, putting the origins of football into the game books. There were lots of things that we tried to find out about hoods and different ways, you know. So there is a Haxie Hood game, you know, and that gave us inspiration because we were researching folk tales, and I came up with it. Well, look, there's a hood game, so we've got to get this in somehow. And yeah, so lots of good fun things.
Tell me, Graham, are you still involved in the hobby? Do you still play?
I don't play any role-playing game. I've got two sons, and they both do. I play board games, and I do a little bit of board game inventing. And I was writing ad hoc for a while. I had a whole year, 1986 approximately, when I was writing. And even when I went back to work, I said, I'll come back to work for 11 months of the year and give me a month off and I'll carry on writing. And that worked for 1 year. And then the next year, my employer unfortunately said, I can't really do this anymore. You need to either be here or not be here. So it was a bit of a shame. But really, after that, the writing went away. The old Amstrad PCW rather got packed up and hasn't ever come out again.
But you're still inventing games, still trying to find use for those IBM punch cards.
And I find games that you can play in an hour, I can get my satisfaction and my kick out of. Having said that, I will go away, and I do go away once or twice a year to games conventions still, and play board games for 3 or 4 days in a row. So maybe I should get back into role-playing games. I have a good friend who is also a board game designer, and she I know enjoys freeform live action type games, which I think I would, you know, I probably ought to give it a go sometime. But it's as you get a bit older. I did always say to myself, yeah, I've got to go and have a proper career, and maybe when I retire, And back in the day, we all thought we were going to retire at 50, which obviously hasn't happened. But, you know, I did keep saying to myself, when I retire, I'll go back to writing. And unfortunately, I've got about another 7 years before I can sensibly think about retiring at the moment. So I sort of stay in touch. There is a magazine, Other Hands. I don't know if you're aware of it.
No, I don't know that
Thomas,
one.
Thomas Morwinski, I think his name is. A couple of other people. So it's sort of online, and they publish material, and they've been in touch a few times to, well, actually asked me if I would mind having some of my stuff republished. So I gave them permission to use a White Dwarf scenario and so on. And the other very interesting thing that nearly happened is that Robin of Sherwood has come back as an audio play. So they actually got quite a few people from the original cast back together, including, I'm pretty sure it was with Jason Connery as well, and recorded whether it was one or more episodes. And they were trying to crowdfund doing some more. And they did approach Paul and I to see if we could either adapt into a script or write a script for them. But that seems to have died a death. I think the crowdfunding probably didn't quite go as far as they needed it to. So that was only last year. Nothing's forgotten, it seems. Nothing's ever forgotten, to quote a line from the show.
Well, when we're planning on setting up a retirement home called Dungroggin, and we'll make sure that when you're ready, there's a place for you, Graham. Thank you very much for spending the time with us.
That's a pleasure.
Grogglebox!
Welcome to Ed's Shed. We just watched Robin of Sherwood together, an episode selected by the Grog Squad, Seven Poor Knights from Acca, which was first transmitted on the 12th of May, 1984. So, hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
Hello, Ed.
Hello, Dirk.
So, this is the first time in 35 years that we've watched something together like this, isn't it? Like, watched Robin and Sherwood together.
That's right.
And I remember this time in 1984, we're just about to leave school. We should have been revising for our exams at this time, yeah, shouldn't we?
Well, we didn't, did we?
No.
Not at all.
That's why we've ended up where we
are. Yeah. Any younger listeners, that is the thing to do. Don't revise for them. Despite what everyone tells you.
Yeah, watch Robin and Sherwood.
What we turned out all right.
Yeah. So we're about to leave school. We should have been studying. But at that time, you used to come early, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Eddie, and we used to go to Blythe's house, and we used to watch it together before gaming, because then Herbs, Winnie and Swab would turn up and we'd have a game. And about that time we were going to Griffin Mountain, weren't we?
Mm. Herbert was running it, weren't he?
Yeah.
It was a bit like a starter before the main course, wasn't it? Robin Sherwood would put you in the mood.
That's
put you in
right,
the mood for it, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It was perfect setting, weren't it?
Yeah.
But just let me ask, is it Acca or Acre?
I was going to say that.
I thought it was Acre.
It's
Acca.
It's Acca. Are you sure?
No. It is, because it's based, it's a town in the Middle East.
Is it?
Acca, yeah. It's spelled Acre, but it's Acca. It is.
There you go.
And
I've learned something.
But we can't say that now. We've got to start saying Acre all the way through.
You can call it Acre. If you want to call it Acre.
And is it Nathletep or Nathalie? And is it Pavis or Pavis? Can we clarify? Forget Robin Shield. Forget it. Let's talk about how you pronounce things.
It's Acre. And apparently there's an Assassin's Creed game that's actually set in the contemporary, killing the against the Templars.
Yeah, they're interesting because they're kind of quite villainous, aren't they? You know, they're not portrayed as nice people at all in this episode. I don't think they were anywhere, but
no,
it's quite interesting because there are films and stuff where they're not portrayed in a bad way, but in this they definitely are, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, we'll go through scene by scene and talk people through it, but this is known as the one with the Knights Templar in.
Yeah. It stands out, doesn't it?
Yeah. And at that time, the Knights Templar were very popular, weren't they?
Yes.
I don't think
people were trying to join them. They had long since gone, but I'd say.
Well, they were somewhat buzzing around the role-playing scene, weren't they, with the Knights Templar? Mm. I don't know what they were ninjas in the White Dwarf at that time. Yeah. Like, you'd come across them, couldn't you, in the Knights Templar? I don't know what they were in.
They were like fads, weren't they? Like you say, like the Far East, and Templars came in because of the Holy Blood and Holy Grail and all the associations with conspiracy theories.
Yeah, because that was published in about 82, wasn't it? Early 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s, but it was still buzzing around, I think, and, you know, connections with the Masons and...
That's right.
Secret societies that,
Okay, so let's go through this. Okay, so it starts. The episode begins. There's always like a pre-credit sequence.
Isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Some are better than others.
Yeah.
And this one's got Seaward running. Yeah, the one-eyed peddler running away.
Yeah.
Through the thing, and he comes across the Knights Templar appearing. And there's always somebody coming from outside into Sherwood Forest.
Yeah, that's a common theme, isn't it? You've got the Sheriff of Nottingham and Gisborne, who are the main baddies, but they're not actually the worst baddies. It tends to work, but some rather more villainous character comes from outside.
Yeah.
Either a sorcerer or a witch or a whoever. And in this case, it's the Templars, isn't it? But that is the structure of a lot of the episodes is like that.
Because they always have to defeat somebody, don't they?
Yeah.
They can't defeat the sheriff.
Yeah. And often the outsider villains are a problem for the sheriff as well.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a common theme in Robin Sherwood.
When they meet later on in the episode, you get that sense, don't you, that he just sees them as expedient of getting rid of Robin and Sherwood. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So at this point, they see them praying together, don't they? And you get they're speaking in French
at night.
At night,
for some reason. Why is it night time? We missed usually.
Yeah,
it just looks spooky.
It's spooky.
We're going to do some praying.
Highly religious spooky. Christian night. Yeah.
And it focuses in on the pendant, the gold pendant, showing the Knights Templar riding a horse together, and then it cuts to the title sequence.
Yeah,
you don't have to do it, but
it's a great soundtrack,
one of the best.
It is
okay, and it starts off, and then we meet the Merry Men.
Mm.
And we know there's a problem because there's a new one, don't we? So when he
dies soon.
There's two,
isn't there?
Yeah.
Is it James and Martin?
Dickon. Yeah. Were it Dickon and Martin?
Yeah, I think James Martin replacing Dickon.
James Martin, not James Martin. Not the celebrity chef. James and Martin.
They were replacing Dickon, who died.
Oh, right. Because he died in the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Because what number is this one? Is it the third?
The fourth, I think.
Right. Yeah, it's quite early on, isn't it? This?
Yeah.
So they're still knocking around soon, you know, with NPCs stamped on their head, more or less, with no lines, because you have to pay more, I think, with equity rules then, and soon to die.
Yeah, and they're practicing archery.
Yes.
And the way that this scene works is all the time you're hoping, as they're swinging that sack and firing an arrow, and Much the Miller's son, he's swinging it. You're hoping that he's going to get it.
Someone rolls a 96, hit near his friend. Oh no, hit near his halfwit. Much.
But it's ridiculous, that scene, because you don't shoot arrows into the forest like that because you never find them again.
You're
never looking for them arrows. You fire it against a wall or a hay bale or some wood or something, or at least an open field where you can find the bloody things.
Yeah.
You don't fire them into the woods.
Yeah, wasting ammo. How easy is it?
Because he missed them all, isn't
it? How easy is it to make a proper arrow? You're just wasting a load of them, aren't you?
Yeah,
true that.
And they all fail except for Marion.
Yes.
Who hits the sack.
Yeah.
Make your own jokes.
Yeah.
And then
Robin, who hits the rope. He's in the hold in this. He goes one better, doesn't he?
Of course he does.
Goes one better because he's Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
You need to bear that in mind later on, I think. He can shoot the string off a bag from 100 paces.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about this in the next few scenes to come.
Just call back to that.
We'll
bear that in mind.
And what's interesting in this scene as well is this is a recurring thing where Will Scarlet is challenging Robin on his tactics. So he's saying, why don't we just kill Gisborne? Why don't we go and kill him? And Robin's saying, well, he's good for us.
Because he's stupid. He's not liked.
He's not liked. Mm. The peasants are coming onto our side because he's so... Yeah.
Such a dubious position, I think.
Yeah. It's a chaotic good position.
But it's a dubious position because what he's suggesting there, that implication is that if you kill Gisborne, a Norman overlord may come along who is liked.
Yeah,
and if they're liked, because maybe they're kind. So essentially, it's Robin Hood's fault peasants are suffering. All he needs to do is kill Gisborne, the world might change for the better. Dubious
because
position.
Wasn't there a previous episode where they have him on a ducking stool or something, Gisborne?
Mm.
Are they ducking him into a
river? Yeah, they capture him a few times, don't kill him. Kill everyone else, but not him. Yeah.
But they're giving a reason here, aren't they?
That's right.
It's his tactic, isn't it? He's a useful fool because... The peasants are...
It's a bit like Robin Hood wants to create suffering and mayhem so that he can create some kind of socialist utopia from the ashes of it by keeping Gisborne burning villages. Sorry, all your villages are burnt, but in the long run, it'll be good for everyone. I'm not sure it stacks up.
So they find the peddler hiding, don't they? And
Seawood.
And he's trying to shake...
He's not a peddler, he's a thief.
He says he's a peddler, doesn't he?
Level 15 rogue.
Level 15. With one eye.
15?
Yeah, but we don't want to spoil it for anybody.
It's full of spoilers.
Well, he survives. What happens to the guy? He actually lives, doesn't he? He doesn't actually comment. It doesn't show him at the end, but he actually survives because he rescues him, doesn't he?
We'll get to that later. And just ahead of that, they get attacked.
Mm. They get attacked by Templars.
And run like headless chickens in a circle, don't they?
They do.
You know, instead of like, they should have had that planned out, shouldn't they? Like, if we get some knights riding into our camp, we each go in different directions, as you do. And run like the clappers in one direction, not in circles.
There's trees everywhere running into the trees.
They're on one opening in Sherwood Forest.
Yeah.
And these are all deadly marksmen, aren't they? Well, at least one of them is.
One of them is. You could take them off the horses with the longbow, just pick them off, couldn't you? Yeah, that's true.
I think we should mention as well, there's an issue, I think, in Robin and Sherwood about noisy horses. Right?
Mm.
Whenever a horse appears in a scene, if it's walking, if it's running, or doing anything, it's got to make a noise. Have you ever been on a horse? They don't make much of a noise, do they?
No.
They just move.
It's quiet, aren't they? It's fed up. Right around all bloody day with someone on
the back. I think if you watch the horses closely, then the horses on film are not making that noise. No. They're whinnying, but they're not whinnying. It's like a weird overdubbing, like a foreign language film for horses.
To let you know these horses.
Yeah. If you're a horse watching that, you'd think, they're not English horses, they're foreign, they've overdubbed it.
They do overdub it. They overdub it because when they go into villages as well, the chickens all sound mad.
I think the opening scene where he's in the forest, the bird song is incredibly like loud. There's a lot of bird song. Yeah. They go a bit crazy with the sound effects. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's intentional, because they wanted the forest to be part of the actual thing.
It's not necessarily a bad thing all the time, but you're right, there's a lot of sound effects.
Every time a horse walks on,
it's
always got to go.
It's the one soundbite they paid for.
I think what he does quite well, though, that scene where they're attacked. I take the point that there's a bit of it's slightly comical, as you say, they're running around in circles instead of just running into the trees. But it does give you a feeling of what it must be like to be charged by men with armour on horseback when you've not really got the height they've got on them and their speed, the advantage that you've got on a horse that. They do quite a good job of bringing that across, where they're kind of towering above them in metal on a big horse and you're on the ground with a quarterstaff, and you think, oh, you really haven't got a chance, have you, if one of these guys comes at you?
No.
You know, and it does portray that quite well. And I think back in the day, that's what we liked about it, that it does, whilst it's not, it does kind of show sometimes how combat would have played out, because the combat's not fancy schmancy combat that you sometimes see in modern things where everyone's whizzing around like a kung fu fighter. It's kind of quite blunt and brutal, and being charged by men on horseback, you get that feeling of they trip up, you know, they're running away from the horse and they'll trip up, and then suddenly the horse is on top of them, and it does feel, whilst I take the point, running around in circles not particularly realistic, but in another sense it is realistic. It gives you a sense of how terrifying that must have been, you know.
So James cops it, doesn't he? And they capture Much.
They do.
And he has a pained expression on his face. Or is that just an expression he has?
He's permanently constipated. That's really what's wrong with him.
And then it cuts to, we get to meet them without the helmets on. Because, of course, we get a post box view, don't we? We get a temple's eye view.
Yeah.
breathing. Asthmatic breathing.
Touch the Darth Vaders about it, didn't they? Yeah.
But they take the helmets off, and what's going on with his hair?
The spiky punk hair.
Yeah, he has. He's got a big punk haircut, hasn't he, for the 12th century? Yeah.
I think it's just static electricity from the helmet, though.
Those huge old bucket helmets, aren't they? I mean, when you're kind of a role playing game, you look at those helmets and think, I'm not wearing a helmet like that. You know, my fighter might have a closed helm, but he doesn't want
one
like that.
It's not like that. Literally, it's like a dustbin, isn't it?
A dustbin, yeah. Dusty bin from 3-2-1. I think 3-2-1 had stopped then, so maybe they resprayed the dusty bins and said, stick these on your head, fellas.
And and there's also the guy from Acorn Antiques, isn't there?
There is. Duncan
Preston?
Impressive scar.
Impressive scar. And then they have a funeral pyre, don't they, for their fallen comrade. Yeah. And we get to meet the Sheriff of Nottingham and Guy of Gisborne.
Yeah.
Gisborne comes along and they start to talk. Now you've already heard, haven't you? Because Friar Tuck's already said, oh, I can tell you some stories about them.
The Templars.
Very camp.
Yeah. Oh, I can tell you. The stories I can tell you. And we already know.
Like a cast off from how you're being served, isn't he, at the time?
But also, the Sheriff kind of underlines that, doesn't he? Because he can. Like you say, the Templars in this, they're not a mystical paladins, are they? They're like hard nosed mercenaries, aren't they?
Yeah.
Who've come from the Holy Land.
Why Gisborne and the Sheriff would have known who they were anyway, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Because apparently later on, 2,000 of them were in Lincoln or something.
Yeah, they're always in Lincoln.
For a festival.
Everyone's in Lincoln, aren't they? I can't understand as well, is they're coming back from the Holy Land to Lincoln via Nottingham. Is that a route that you would take? I'm not sure it is. I always think everyone's going to Lincoln or from Lincoln. I mean, it's a hell of a long way from Nottingham to Lincoln to start with, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, they're always popping over to Lincoln, aren't they, to the shops. Oh, come on, to Lincoln.
Lincoln or Kirklees, which is even
further. Kirklees, God almighty. Yeah. I never really found a study. Oh, we're on our way back from the Holy Land. Have you got lost?
So it's at this point, isn't it? It's at this point where the Sheriff says, one of the best lines in it, I think, is he asks Gisborne, do you see yourself as... This country is like a sponge.
Yeah.
So it's taking... people, do you see yourself as a Norman or as an Englishman? And Gisborne says, as a Norman. I thought you'd say that.
Well, that's the first time you see the Sheriff being human, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yes, that's true.
He's a pantomime villain, isn't he?
Yeah.
That's the first, probably the first and only time in the entire series he actually comes out with that line. I wonder if it was meant for somebody else.
I do think there's times, and you're right, that... By it's like episode 4, isn't it? And suddenly you see a slightly different side to him. And whilst he's a villain, because he's a kind of cruel ruler, isn't he? He's a kind of bullying, nasty fella in one sense. But I think throughout the series, you do see sides to him where you think, when he's surrounded by others of his kind, like King John, who's a bit of a nasty, Phil Davis plays King John in some episodes, yeah. Quite nasty. I think you do see how he's in a world of people like that. And in some senses, he's probably not the worst person in the normal world.
He's just out for himself, but not in a nasty sense, is he?
He's out for himself and just wants people to do as they're told. Yeah. You know, why can't they just do as they're told and leave me alone? And he's under pressure, isn't he? He's under, like, performance indicators from King John to collect taxes and do this and do that. So he's not a sympathetic character, that's going a bit too far, but he is portrayed sometimes as human and I don't know, you're not on his side, but sometimes you think, he's under a bit of pressure there, you know.
and I think in this stage he is kind of deferent to them, isn't he? Because he realises that they're under a higher command than him. Yeah. So he kind of leaves them to it.
The King of Kings.
Yeah. Yes. And he gets embarrassed, Gizmo, and says, you know, the half-wit, when he sees Much the Miller's son, he kind of gets annoyed with him, doesn't he?
Yes, he's embarrassed.
Embarrassed in front of them.
And I think that's the thing that makes him human, that he's a villain driven by things like that, by embarrassment and social standing, and doesn't want to appear like a fool, and it puts him in an ill temper. So he's kind of happy to get people killed just so he doesn't look stupid in front of his peers.
That's right.
You know? It's quite a very good. It's a very good portrayal, really, and he does steal. When I was watching it, as soon as he appears, I thought, "Oh, good, here we are." The sheriff of Nottingham. Yeah. He steals the show. He steals every scene he's in, doesn't he? Really.
Well, what is it? Alan Rickman. I think he based his character on it, didn't he? Right. Alan Rickman in the Prince of Thieves, whatever it was.
Yeah. Is it Nicholas Grace? Is it the actor?
Yeah,
Grace.
Yeah, it's very good.
Really, really good.
So then we don't really know. Why the at this stage? Why the Templars are after Robin? Do we?
No,
you know. So at that point, there's this trial by combat, isn't there? This is a big scene there.
Yeah, they capture Robin. Robin tries to rescue Much, doesn't he? But gets caught.
Yeah.
Then he's put to trial by combat, isn't he?
Yeah.
Because they have a funeral pyre, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
For one who died.
Yeah.
Who got knocked off his horse by
Little
John's quarterstaff.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, critical hit there, I think. Which quite. Because they clear the ashes very quickly after that, don't they? And they have a fight on the ash pile. Which is why Robin has a blacked out, silly face later on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When he gets back to the woods.
Yeah.
Is that spoiling the scene?
I know.
He gets back to the woods with I thought he was going to sneak back in undercover at night later, but he wasn't. He just got a black face because of the
ashes.
Soot, which is a bit silly.
I bet they tried that. I tell you what, I'll put some ash on my face. If you want to do that, Michael, you do that. Yeah, that's Michael, fine. Yeah. Good idea. Don't let it upset your hair.
Don't just spoil your hair.
Yeah. So they have this battle, don't they? Acorn Antiques, man. And
What's he called? Heinrich von Schnaffelschnauder or something. It's like something out of a Warhammer game, isn't he? Like Heinrich von Schnaffelschnauder. He has one line, I think, doesn't he? In a German accent, that's it.
And they have this trial, and it's a shield and morning star.
Mm. Yeah, like flail, isn't it?
So, and a flail. And it's just there to make a lot of noise, isn't it?
Clump. But they look nasty, then, though, do you not think? You wouldn't like one of them hitting your elbow, would you?
Anyway.
It's not, again, going back to the other fight, it was a very clumsy but authentic looking.
Yes, I was just going to say that, and that's what is interesting about it.
Because at the time, you don't want to get hit with one of them.
No, it's a clumsy and slightly brutal fight. It's not choreographed, is it?
No.
I mean, it will have been choreographed, but it doesn't look choreographed.
No.
I think if you saw that in a modern thing now, with two people fighting with shields and morning stars, there'd be all sorts of things, wouldn't there?
Yeah,
it'd be
acrobatics.
Slow-mo and a bit of acrobatics.
Cameras jipping all over the place.
It's not, it's like this big, you know, Acorn Antiques German man really going at a slightly smaller Robin Hood and swinging it at him and knocking him over. And the way when it hits the shield, it kind of knocks him to the floor. Mm,
yeah.
And it did, you know, whether it's, it's like all these things in film, whether it's authentic, as in would it have really been like that or not, it looked authentic. And I think that's why we used to like it, because you could watch the fights and go, Oh, look, yeah, they're using Morningstar flails. Oh, yeah, this is what it is. Yeah, like, I see how that
probably
works.
The only fight we ever saw with Morningstar.
Is it possibly the only fight in ever. TV history with Morningstar flails? Sure, couldn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I think that was what it felt when you watched it. Because even the sword fight, when he gets captured, he has a sword fight with the French kind of leader of the Templars, doesn't he? And that is quite a kind of, I don't know, ballsy fight where they're kind of falling over and really going at each other.
Yeah, that's right.
No, they are good. They are good fights.
Yeah.
So Robin runs away.
Yes.
And assures Much he'll be back. Although if he wasn't, we wouldn't have been that bothered.
We wouldn't have been bothered, no.
It's his brother, isn't it? His half-brother or something.
He sets the time, though, doesn't he? He sets the guy with the haircut turns around and he says, we're going to hang him soon, so you better hurry up back. But in French.
Maybe that's what the real gripe is between him and Robin. Who's got the best haircut? Robin's gone for the prog rock long locks. And he's gone for the more punky. Maybe it's a punk prog rock thing, really. That's what's really going on.
Has he been in anything before, that guy? He is French.
I think he's quite a well-known French actor.
I'd seen his face then.
Yeah, I think he's quite well-known in France. Again, that was one of the little ticks in the box. I think that using a proper French actor to play a Frenchman
was,
admittedly, the German is the man from Ecole Antique. He's probably born in Barnsley. But the main French guy is French,
Or Preston, because he's called Duncan Preston.
Do you think he made that one?
I don't know. I would work like that, does it? he can't say anything about the hair, because you used to have your hair like Michael Praed in the 80s, around this time.
It's a bit later that. 84, it was short.
It's hard.
I'd had it cut when I left school in the hope of getting a job that soon.
But realising it would say more than that.
Yeah, it's more than a haircut. So I grew it again, because there weren't any jobs in Bolton in the 80s. So we're ending all in college.
Yeah, it has to be said before we move on to the next scene. We used to admire Michael Praed quite a bit, didn't we?
He's quite cool.
Because he's there, and he's a good looking fellow, isn't he?
He's the ideal hero, isn't he?
Yes, he is. He's
kind of the one you would model your character on.
Yeah, he does look the part, doesn't he? Really, if you kind of this is one of the strengths of the series in some ways. If you had to imagine Robin Hood, he's kind of like, oh yeah, that's what you would imagine him to look like. Yeah.
You would know, wouldn't you? Because he's done it. He's like a proper ranger, isn't he?
Yeah. He's not like a daft fella with a feather in his hat and green tights on, is he? He's not kind of like that Robin Hood. He's more, he just has a kind of look.
The costumes still stand the test of time, though, don't they?
I seem to remember that you asked your sister to make us hoods. We had hoods.
Yeah, we did. And we went LARPing, is it?
Yeah.
I'm sure it weren't called LARP back then.
It was called LARPing. Was it?
Up in Newton Le Willows.
Yeah, we had.
It's called messing about.
Mucking around. With so much time on our hands because we didn't have jobs.
Despite the haircuts.
So, Seward gets captured in Nottingham, doesn't he?
Mm.
And this is where we find out why they're after him, because he's stolen the pendant from the Knights Templar. And they think it's Robin and his merry men that have stolen it. So at that point, the Sheriff of Nottingham takes the pendant for himself, doesn't he? And he sleeps with it for some reason. He has the option of putting it in a box.
Sleeps with it. Yeah. Silly
what's,
that.
What's going on there?
What did I think? Is that the scene where he has Seward in front of him?
Yeah, yeah.
And you suddenly have the realisation. It kind of gets you a bit when he asks him, how did you lose that eye?
Yeah.
And suddenly you kind of you feel very sorry for Seward. But suddenly you don't care about him. You think, oh, he's going to lose his other eye.
Well, you know what's coming, yeah. That's true, that.
Yeah, so he says, take out his other eye, yeah.
Then he says, you can't. That Seward says, you can't do that.
Yeah.
What a ridiculous thing to say in that day.
Clearly he can.
Better say, please don't do that. Yeah, you
better get on your knees, say, look, I'll
don't
do anything.
That. Yeah, whatever you want.
And around the same time, conveniently, Robin makes the same thing, doesn't he? He realises that must be the reason. He comes to the same conclusion. So he thinks, right, we've got to get the pendant back.
Yes.
And luckily, He's not being kept in Nottingham, is he?
He's not, no. He's been kept at Marion's old house or something.
Yeah, Leaford Grange.
That's right, yeah. Is it near Lincoln?
Or
Cleve?
Nobody
one,
knows.
One of the two.
Nobody they can't knows. Get into Showcastle. It would be impossible. But fortunately...
He's doing the rounds, isn't he? Collecting his
tickets. That's right. He's touring the
just happens to be in Marion's all those.
Yeah, he refers to that at the beginning, doesn't he? When he's on, that's when he meets the Templars, because he's doing this grand tour, annual tour of the place. Yeah.
And there always has to be a reason to give Marion something to do, isn't there? And this is a good reason, isn't it? Because this is her family home that she's left. And so she knows it well, and she knows how to get into it, fortunately for him.
Yeah, and there's a bit of when they break in, there's a bit of like pantomime, isn't there? Oh, Nazir and Bride Tuck.
Yeah, so Nazir, who's our favourite character, it has to be said, hasn't it? We all want him to play Nazir. Yeah,
the ruthless assassin.
Yeah.
Has to try and indicate to Friar Tuck by the means of mime that as they're disguised as guards, which they've just killed brutally with one shot, haven't they?
Yeah.
Because it always go over in one blow.
That armour never works. Norman, they need to have a word with the man supplying the armour to the sheriff's Norman soldiers.
One
never
throw dagger.
One blade, you know. A blade dragged across it. The very thing chainmail protects you against. A blade dragged across it rather than punched into it. Still die.
What's that? How many armour points is chainmail? Is it 5? Yeah. A thrown dagger, 1d4 plus 1, is it?
Yeah.
It's got to be a critical, isn't it?
It's got to be critical to him, but isn't it straight in the middle of his chest? That's not a critical, is it? It's like in the neck's a critical.
We had these arguments.
These are the arguments we had all
just
the time.
Throws it.
Yeah. No. Well, it's like Nazir.
These are the weak points.
Everyone wanted to play Nazir, which just led to endless arguments about two-weapon fighting in RuneQuest. I don't think we've ever even resolved it. No. I've got two scimitars, one in each hand. Can I attack twice? That doesn't seem right. Can I parry twice? No. Well, what's the point of having two weapons then? There must be some advantage, but you could never quite simulate it in the game. Never work it out, could you?
So having dispatched the guards at Leaford Grange, they have this routine, don't they, where Nazir, by the power of mime, is telling the fright up to lift his frock up.
Cassock, his
tussocks. Hide his tussocks, because it's giving him away. And Gisborne comes out and you have a look, and you just see these like very pale legs, don't you? Going across.
Yeah.
He's hidden by a shield, isn't he?
Yeah.
They have two shields in the direction of Gisborne, don't they?
Still completely implausible.
Yeah.
Despite him lifting his cassock or his tussock, he's still totally implausible. And it makes you realise if Specsavers had existed and Gisborne had glasses, they'd have been done for. Gisborne obviously has eyesight issues.
That's right. It's low light as well. It's going dusk, isn't it? Well, it's filtered to look like dust.
So they recover the pendant, don't they? They get it back, and they start to take it back to the Templars. Yeah,
that's a good scene though, where he's recovering the
pendant.
Where he's opening the keys on the box, isn't it?
Yeah,
and you just know the sheriff's gonna get up. And he's trying the one, and it keeps flashing back to the sheriff in bed.
You see him get out of bed, no?
You do, you get his legs sticking out.
Yeah.
And he goes there with his keys, just suddenly a knife's out of his throat, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Seward's throat, and then suddenly Gizmo gets dragged back by Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And then you don't see Seward again, I don't think, do you?
No, you assume he got away, but you're not sure, right?
In fact,
no.
Why did they free him? Why did they free Seward? Is it... Because he's a professional thief, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's not a peddler, is he?
He tries to pick the lock, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's a level 15 thief, so they just wanted his thing. But he failed his role, didn't he?
Yeah.
He's clearly not level 15 then, is he?
Or did he fail his role, or were they always intending him to disturb him?
Yeah, that's
true. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see
he's
this.
Like a decoy.
Decoy, yeah.
Yes.
There's a lot of that goes on in Robin and Sherwood, a lot of decoy.
There's a lot of these guys, and there's a lot of questions about why don't you just wake the sheriff up with a knife to his throat and say, give it here.
Yeah,
and tie him up. Yeah.
And why on earth are you sleeping with it?
Yeah, why are you sleeping with it, yeah?
What's going on? You got a big box there.
Yeah, in the box. It's weird.
I'll sleep with the box.
Yeah. When does a treasure item of treasure, you stop sleeping with it, you know? Weird going on. I think the thing with that treasure, though, as well, what's interesting about it is, there's often in Robin Sherwood a level of kind of mysticism, isn't there? about stuff. And there's often magic in it. So there's often sorcerers and stuff. And there's no magic in this episode. But even without magic, that medallion thing is given a sort of mystical quality,
an aura,
isn't
to it?
It, so in this one, there's this very low-level mysticism. There's no Herne the Hunter. You know, the old fellow with antlers on his head doesn't appear out of the mist. And there's no magic. But even that, that pendant has a sort of mystical quality, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
It's a very, very kind of heavily laden with that, Robin Sherwood, about mysticism. And stuff.
Well,
like
it makes
that
a big deal, doesn't it? But, you know, they travelled through the Holy Land and fought against all these people, but managed to get it stolen by Petty.
One-eyed Petty.
So it's kind of, the sheriff takes great pleasure in it, but you can see that it has got some significance, hasn't it?
But it is that thing as well where, in Robin Sherwood, Christianity is never portrayed well, is it? So you've got that mystical stuff and pagan stuff going on, but Christianity is never portrayed particularly well in Robin Sherwood.
No.
It's out like the religion of the oppressors,
yeah,
isn't
right.
it? You know, because you've got
Friar Tuck.
Friar Tuck's almost like kind of defected and become some kind of, I don't know what he's become, some kind of, I don't know, half pagan, half Christian monk, hasn't
he? That's right.
He's kind of bought into Robin's.
Half pantomime, half horse.
Half pantomime, yes.
Well, the church is there to be kicked, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like, the sheriff's brother,
Hugo.
He's an abbot, isn't he? And he's a nasty piece of work. So the church is very, you know, kind of negative, isn't it? The paganism is, you know, it's an interesting like split in it, isn't it?
So we go back to the Templars' camp. And they're about to hang Much, aren't they?
Yeah.
Does death hurt? Stupid face, he says. And you know that this is a tense bit. Because not only are the chickens going mad, and the horses, you get that thing with the kettle drums, do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Boom!
Boom!
But it's the Colonnad Slane track, isn't it?
Yeah.
As good as it is, and it makes a great album, it's a little bit misplaced at times, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think they lack a bit of tense, so maybe they've picked out bits that of the end.
Boom.
That was the last drum of a song. So they shove that in.
Can't
have like a dance.
A bit of tension, yeah. It's Clannad, they don't do tension. They do like fairy folk villages and misty forests. But
that's right. Tension, no. Combat scene. No.
I can't remember how does Robin rescue him, eh? I can't remember.
He gives him the
he comes in with the medallion,
He comes in with the medallion.
Yeah.
With the medallion, and then the knights double cross him because they attack him afterwards, don't they?
He takes the medallion, and he says, "Can I have my sword back?" Because he took his sword, doesn't he?
And
he
said,
"No, you stole it or something, so I'll keep it." So they let him go.
Yeah.
But obviously Robin's a bit annoyed because his sword's been kept. And they're walking away and you could see the Templars getting ready with their helmets. Cue the breathing.
Yeah.
And they start to chase him. And
it's an ambush.
It's an ambush, yeah.
Yeah, they get the rope, knock them off the horses, don't they?
One of the most silly. He's a trained knight. Piece of slack, not exactly wire across it.
Guerrilla warfare.
It's not the great escape, is it?
Yeah. Chop their heads off. Cheese wire.
So they all suddenly end up on the floor, don't they?
Yeah.
Bumbling around, he's like Emily. You think they train falling off an horse and getting up quickly?
Yeah, what happened at Templar School? Right, what today we're going to look at what happens if you fall off your horse?
Yeah.
Are you dead? Are you got? Is that the end of game over, or can you actually get up with your sword and swing your sword around?
And we've always had this sense like the longbow's most deadliest weapon in medieval. We can punch through mail armour. Why did they bother with any of that? Why did they just say, okay, you hang Much?
Yeah.
But you're obviously going to Lincoln after this, and you'll be dead before you get there because we're going to hunt you the whole way through Lincoln, pepper you with arrows.
Yeah.
So you're never going to get there.
Yeah.
They
could have just gone from the forest and rained arrows on them.
Yeah. 100 yards, you can cut a string on a bag.
Exactly. I think that's the fatal mistake made in the plot, isn't it? He can do that with the rope, but what he can't do is sit just outside a village and pick a man-sized object off.
Yeah.
Get
through that slot in his
straight in the eye.
Just get an arrow in him.
I don't have it.
You're not having that.
Yeah, he's only good at rolling.
They run in, then put swords to the next, and then they cut the scene up.
Yeah, and then They take the pendant and melt it down, don't they, the medallion?
Yeah, yeah. And they're seen riding off on a horse, aren't they? They're,
with Noah.
Yeah, Akon Antiques, man. Sir Heinrich Akon Antiques and the French punk are seen.
Which is a symbol of the...
Plastic Bertrand.
Two on a horse, isn't it? Yeah. On the medallion. The Knights in Poverty.
You know, we love this programme, but anyone who's not seen it is probably thinking...
It's going to put them off, absolutely crap. We didn't want this to be a... We haven't done.
It is brilliant, and actually, it still stands up to watching, I think. Still stands up. It's okay. It's pretty good, you know. And if it was on today... You know, it would be, you know, it stands up to scrutiny, I think.
We loved it. We did love it because it influenced our game such a lot.
Yes.
But everything we've said, no, we used to say at the time, we used to criticise the battles in it.
Yeah. I think that's testament to how good it is, actually, because in a way, if you watch something like that that's just rubbish, you won't watch it, you'll just give up on it, and B, you won't criticise whether... you could hit someone with a longbow from that range, or whether a flail would really work like that, because you wouldn't be engaging, would it, as a thing? It was an engaging watch, and that led you to those arguments of thinking, oh, would you do it that way? Would you do it this way? You know, and as you say, it informed our role playing, because each episode was like a role playing game.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the crucial things about it.
It was like a scenario.
It was like a scenario, and they were a band of adventurers. And they were faced with a problem. And when you watched it, you'd unpick it as if you were the player character. So that, what you just said, of thinking, the way I'd do it is I'd try and hit them with a longbow from the village, from outside the village. That was the strength of it. That's why I think we loved it. And that's why the people of our generation loved it, who liked role-playing. Because it did feel like a role-playing game. The Merry Men were all like role-playing characters. They were like characters you would play were playing a role-playing game.
The flaws like that. You see, some of the cameo roles, like I always liked Alan Adele, but I also liked the Seawood character in this.
Yeah.
I thought she was great. I would have picked that character to play in there.
The characters were very well drawn. It was very well written. The dialogue was good. Everything about it's kind of convincing. So despite being able to poke fun at it, it was very convincing, and it felt like a role playing game. You could probably take any episode of Robin Sherwood and turn it into a one-shot role-playing scenario very, very easily, and it would be very enjoyable. You know, this gets stolen, you get blamed for it, you've got to go and steal it off the sheriff because he's got it now, give it back, rescue an NPC, you get double-crossed by the knights at the end. That's the makings of a great scenario, isn't it?
Really? Well, that's why it was quite difficult to pick an episode, because they're all very good. I don't think there's a bad episode. In the first two seasons of this show, the third, I don't really know it that well with Jason Connery.
Yeah. But we don't know that one.
It goes off the boil then, don't
it? Yeah, we were getting older though. Yeah, I think we touched on this at the beginning. Tree sounds. I think my favourite scenes are the ones where the outlaws are mucking around in the forest.
Because
it's sunshine. I mean, it's great if you suffer from seasonally adjusted depression. You don't need YouTube with bird song. Just put Robin Sherwood on with it and watch the kind of opening scenes with the mucking around and the sunshine in the forest.
Yeah.
Or there's one where they're playing quarterstaffs on a bridge.
Yeah.
Well, do you not think that takes you back to your childhood? Because, you know, even we live in Bolton, there was like bits of greenery around, wasn't there, where we used to go and play. In the 70s, you'd go and play by a stream. There might be an old shopping trolley in it and a few copies of Razzle, but that was our like Sherwood Forest as kids.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And over the summer holidays, you'd be playing that, and that's what I think Robin and Sherwood plays on, that kind of particular English countryside of like.
Yeah, it is English, isn't it?
Yeah. Because it was filmed on film stock rather than video, has that kind of soft focus, which is how I remember. That's how I remember. Nostalgic for it, because that's how I remember playing in those kind of environments when I was a kid.
Yeah,
the soft focus element. It's almost like a memory of your own being played out in front of you, almost, isn't it? by actors, that is a vague memory of something
that
you played as a kid. Yeah, in the forest. Yeah. Messing about with like a rope, building a rope swing or something. The kind of thing that kids did. And that's what, in some ways, that's what they're doing. There are scenes where they're goofing around in Sherwood Forest, you know, which again are kind of well-drawn scenes where it's not all fighting and serious. They're just mucking about, aren't they? Yeah. Like people perhaps would, even if you're an outlaw. Yeah. You are going to have a laugh every now and again.
I think it touched on that element of escapism that was big in the 80s. You know, travellers and... not travellers as we know them now, they'll just go around in hippie vans and go to festivals and things like that. I think there's an element of that. God, I want to do that. I don't want a job.
Yeah.
Who wants a job in 1984? Just get in a van and muck around in the forest.
Yeah. No one is. Like Vashti Bunyan and going across Ireland in a caravan and trying to find Donovan or something.
Yeah, there's like escapism in there. Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why we watched it.
Yeah.
I watched it anyway. Wasn't just the RPG element. Yeah. Just like getting away from life.
Yeah. And what do we think about this episode overall compared with the others? So if you had to choose another one for us to watch, which ones would you go for? What would you go for, by then?
I would go for The Children of Israel.
Yeah.
Which is a good one about kind of Jewish family who get persecuted by the sheriff. And he has a pogrom in Nottingham against them because he owes the Jewish guy money. You know, so it's a bit of a cliched kind of view of a kind of Shylock character who's lent the sheriff money, and the sheriff can't or doesn't want to pay it back. So he sort of stirs up racial hatred for the Jews. But it's a good one because, again, a bit like the Templar one, it talks about something historically accurate that, you know, Jewish people being persecuted in the Middle Ages, that's what happened. And also, it's got, there's a bit of it where Will Scarlet goes rogue. He gets fed up of being under Robin's command and he becomes a proper outlaw. And that's quite an interesting thing because that relationship between Robin Sherwood and Will Scarlet is one of the most interesting relationship in it in some ways. And it's also got a bit of magic in it as well.
Develops Gisborne a bit, doesn't it?
Develops Gisborne because he fancies the daughter of the Jewish fella.
Rebecca.
That's right. And he kind of tips them off that, oh, they're going to come for you, you know. And again, it develops him as a character.
He becomes more human, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Even though he's slightly slanted a bit into it.
He's like a bit of a pillock, isn't he, Gisborne? He's a bit stupid, a bit brutish, but at the same time, you know, he's portrayed in a slightly more sympathetic way, which makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so I like that episode.
What about you, Eddie?
I would have said The Witch of Elsdon, but I think just pips it is Alan O'Dale. Yeah. I don't know something about that one. It's a bit soft. It's a soft episode.
Yeah.
But it's got like...
So it's like done by early CGI bees.
Yeah, that's right. The storyline's so good. He's going to Alan O'Dale traipsing through the forest and they kind of hold him up as they do outlaws. And where are you going? Oh, I'm going to kill the sheriff. And from that moment, you kind of, hey, what's this about? You kind of, and it's his kind of quest. It's a scenario in itself, you know. The NPC rides in, tells him what he's going to do, which is really he's asking for the help. And they're going to do it to rescue the maiden. So I just think it's a perfect scenario, as written in that show.
Mm. One of my favourites is the two-parter with the Hounds of Lucifer in.
Yes.
They're all good, aren't they?
They're all good, really.
The sword's a Wayland, and it's got Rula Lenska in.
Yeah.
Who's after his sword, isn't she?
Who gets more attractive as we get older, don't we?
Yes, that's true. If you watch it now, you think Rula Lenska's all right. At the time, I wasn't sure about it.
A bit old for us.
In fact, it is available on YouTube, that two-parter. And if you're unsure about Robin Sherwood, that's probably the one, isn't it, that's got all of the elements in, hasn't it?
Yes, like, it has. Yeah, devil worship and stuff. And that was a big part of it. That's what made it exciting. That it did have magic in it. Had sorcery, magic, kind of. It didn't have monsters in it, but it had witches and wizards, and it was done very, very well. I think it was done in a very subtle way.
Just the right amount.
Just the right amount. There was a kind of sinister. That Baron, is it Baron de Belem?
De Belem, yeah.
You know, he was a kind of sorcerer who'd come back from the Holy Land and enchanted little John and Nazir right at the beginning, hadn't he? And he was a kind of sinister character, but the magic was done in a very subtle way. I think. Yeah. Done kind of horror. I like a bit Hammer horror, wasn't it? Voodoo and mind control and all that sort of stuff going on. So, you know, it's very, very good.
Mm. So we're going to go and play a game now. It's a bit like the old. We've watched this. What a pity that Herb's Winnie and Swab aren't coming now. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Well, I've got a surprise. I'll be back too.
Herb's Winnie and Swab sound like a solicitors.
So solicitors, yeah.
I wonder what they're doing now. Anyway, answers on a postcard. Thanks a lot. We'll leave your shed now, Ed.
Okay, see you later.
Goodbye.
I'll just make a note for the future episode. We need to tell you that story of LARPing in Newton Le Willows. Rog Coe reminded me that one of the joys of the earlier episodes of the Grog Pod was listening to the stories of fellow gamers from back in the day. So please post your memories on the site at thegrognardfiles.com about Robin of Sherwood, or any other programmes that you used to watch to get you in the mood for playing. April the 12th and 13th is the date for Virtual Grog Meet, an online gaming meetup that we host. There's a great array of games available. Legends of the Five Rings, Call of Cthulhu, Pulp Cthulhu, Knights Black Agents, Flashing Blades and many others. It's a great way of discovering how online play works and meeting fellow gamers. There's loads of groups that spun out of the last one, so please take the opportunity to take part. Check the site for details. It will also mark the official launch of the Grogzine, which is still in production, a little delayed, but it's going out to Patreon supporters soon. We do have a Patreon support to cover the costs, fund other projects, encourage us to continue, and we're always extremely flattered and gracious about the tips thrown into the Patreon virtual beret every month. And we've reached another goal, a Newstalgia podcast, a one-off annual podcast extra, where we'll talk about, in more detail, about the games that we're playing at the moment. And we're going to do it after the UK Games Expo in June. We're running games at the event and we're really looking forward to it. Thanks to everyone who's joined us recently. I'll do some personal shout-outs next time, but for now, I just wanted to thank somebody that I missed last time. Joseph Procopio, thanks. He produced a book, The Lost Art of Ray Wilner, The Adventures of Robin Hood. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm going to give him something because I forgot him. So let me roll on this table here. It's a MERP table. Hearn's Arrow. Next time, we'll be focusing on what's gameable about the Robin of Sherwood series. And we look at Fate Accelerated and how it can be used to replicate the Robin Hood experience. Until then, adios, amigos.